Would you take your Bibles, please, and open up to Ruth chapter 3 as we look tonight at a strange story. This whole story of Ruth has rather an odd background to it. By the way, I thank you for coming. I noticed it was a little thin tonight, and it wasn't until John mentioned the Super Bowl that I remembered that this was Super Bowl Sunday, so shows you just how much of a pro football fan I am. In fact, I don't think it was until a couple days ago that I realized who was playing. I think it's Denver and Seattle. Is that right? Denver and Seattle. Something to do. Yeah. And so thank you for being here tonight. Jane and I always think on Super Bowl Sunday. The very first Super Bowl Sunday that I was a minister and preaching was in Surfside Beach. And that night I went to church and three people showed up. My wife and one other couple and myself. It was a discouraging night. So thank you for being here. Denver's going to win anyhow, so I don't know what all the hoopla is about. If you look at this story, it seems strange to us because it comes from a context that we are very unfamiliar with. In the Old Testament community, in the culture of Boaz and Ruth and Naomi, there was a custom called the Levirate laws. And basically, they were laws set in place by Moses in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy over the span of a 40-year period, in which members of the family would assume responsibilities for other members of their extended family, their relatives and cousins and aunts and uncles and the like, when their marriages, their land, or their freedom were threatened. This particular law that lies behind the story of Ruth was called the law of levirate marriage. That if a man died before his wife was able to conceive and bear children, then it was the responsibility of his brother or a close relative to marry his widow and to bear children for him through her so that his name and his family and his inheritance would continue intact. There was a series of laws, and I want to look at those tonight before we turn to Ruth, that suggest to us that there was a very strong value of family solidarity in the Old Testament that lies behind this story of Ruth and Boaz and Naomi. So I'm going to ask you first to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25, where we'll see Moses lay down this statute, this law, considering called the levirate marriage. Deuteronomy chapter 25, beginning in verse 5. Your brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son. The wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull off his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house, and the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had a sandal pulled off. Obviously, it was a law with some wiggle room, but it was one that was shameful and embarrassing for a man to back out of. That, of course, is the law that lies behind the story of Ruth and Boaz and Naomi. But there were other statutes as well. For example, if you turn to Leviticus chapter 25, there was the law of levirate redemption. When someone was in danger of losing the land of their family inheritance, then the nearest relative, a brother or someone else, was to purchase that land and hold it in trust for the brother or relative who was the rightful owner of it. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possessed you shall allow a redemption of the land. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the years since he sold it, and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and then return to his property. But if he does not have sufficient means to recover it, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his property. The goal here was to keep the tribal and family land in possession of those to whom God gave it, working within the economic limits of the year of Jubilee. Every 50 years, all debts were retired, all land went back to the original family owners, and all slaves were set free. And that's the background of this statute. Further on down in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 47, there's the Levirate statute concerning financial bondage. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 47. If a stranger or sojourner within you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor, and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you, or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle, or his cousin may redeem him, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him. Or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. He shall calculate with his buyer from the year when he sold himself until the year of Jubilee, and the price of his sale shall vary with the number of years. The time he was with the owner shall be rated as the time of a hired worker. If there are still many years left, he shall pay proportionately for his redemption, some of the sale price. If there remains but a few years until the year of Jubilee, he shall calculate and pay for his redemption in proportion to the years of service. He shall treat him as a worker, hired year by year. He shall not rule ruthlessly over him in your sight. And if he is not redeemed by these means, then he and his children with him shall be released in the year of Jubilee. For it is to me that the people of Israel are servants. They are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So here is the Lord saying that I purchased you out of bondage in Egypt. You belong to me, and you shall not be slaves to someone else. And if you get in financial trouble and you have to hire yourself out as an indentured servant, then one of your relatives can redeem you. If not, you'll be released in the year of Jubilee. If you turn over to Numbers chapter 35, you'll find an even more odd Levirate obligation, and that is the law of revenge. When someone is murdered, if the people in the community do not take the proper action to pursue and apprehend and punish the murderer, then the redeemer, the nearest of kin, may find that murderer and strike him down. Leviticus chapter 35, verse 16. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. And if he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. And if he pursued him out of hatred or hurled something at him, lying in wait so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. We could go on and read further in that passage, and the avenger was the nearest of kin who would find someone who was guilty of murder, and if the elders of the city, if the officials didn't take the proper action, then he was allowed to do that as well. This did not include involuntary manslaughter, if an accidental death. That man had a right to flee to one of the cities of refuge and to remain there until the high priest in his life died, and then he was to be set free. But if it was first-degree murder, deliberate murder, then there was no refuge for him, and the nearest of kin should avenge the blood of the family. And finally, in Numbers chapter 5, there's an odd little requirement here. Numbers 5, verse 5, that if someone offended another family, they sinned against them, and they went to the priest, and the priest said, you need to make restitution to that person. But the person who was offended had died. Then the nearest of kin should receive the restitution and make reconciliation between the families. Numbers chapter 5, verse 5. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. When a man or a woman commits any of the sins that people commit by breaking faith with the Lord, and that person realizes his guilt, he shall confess his sin that he has committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it and giving it to him to whom he did the wrong. But if a man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for wrong shall go to the Lord for the priest, in addition to the ram of atonement with which the atonement is made for him. And every contribution, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. In other words, if person A offends person B, and then person B dies, and then they go to the priest and say, I sinned against my neighbor. And the priest says, well, make restitution for him. And the guy says, I can't. He's dead. Then the priest would say, well, then you will make that restitution to the nearest of kin. And that kinsman redeemer, that goel as he's called in the Hebrew, it's his responsibility to receive that payment, to give forgiveness to the offending party, and to make reconciliation between the families. Now, all of this was because of the covenant that God had made with people. David Atkinson says the Goel, that's what he's called, G-O-E-L, the one in these texts in English called the Redeemer or the nearest of kin. He is the Goel, which Boaz was to Naomi and Ruth. The Goel is an institution of family solidarity and a reminder of collective responsibility. These duties among the people of Israel flow from the covenant relationship which they had with the Lord. These duties, which were all prescribed in the Old Testament laws, are only understandable from the background of the covenant that Israel has as a people with God, being his own unique possession among whom he himself dwelt. The land was Jehovah's and was given to Israel through his saving intervention as the powerful Lord of history. Therefore, the land was not to be sold in perpetuity, but was rather to be redeemed. God had redeemed the people of Israel out of Egypt, by which act they became his servants. Therefore, an impoverished Israelite who sold himself into slavery was to be redeemed by this Goel. It is evident then that the responsibilities and privileges of the Goel institution are derived from Jehovah's redemptive action in delivering Israel out of Egypt and out of bondage, bringing her into the promised land and giving her an inheritance. The relationship of the Israelites to each other in terms of this institution is grounded in their covenant relationship with God and with one another. For God said, I will walk among you and be your God, and you all will be my people. Now, this is what lies behind the story of Boaz and Ruth and Naomi. We come here tonight to scene number 4. Each scene is set off by a change of place. Scene number 1 on the plains of Moab. Scene number 2 as they arrive in the town of Bethlehem. Scene number 3 as they're out in the barley field harvesting. And now scene number 4 as they go to the threshing floor. And as Naomi puts into place a plan to secure the services of Boaz as the kinsman redeemer to purchase back her land and Ruth, and to give them an inheritance. There are 3 paragraphs in this story, each one of them involving one of the 3 principal characters in the narrative. There is, first of all, the plan of Naomi, secondly, the proposal of Ruth, and thirdly, the precaution of Boaz. Let's look at this first paragraph, the plan of Naomi, beginning in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our Goel, our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she, that is Ruth, replied, "All that you say, I will do." Now, Naomi has realized she's seen the extreme generosity of Boaz towards Ruth, and she probably figures this man has an eye for Ruth. He's smitten by her. He's taken by her. And she realizes that there is a possibility of the Levirate marriage where Boaz can take Ruth and perform the duty of a near relative to, number one, sustain the life and the legacy of Elimelech and her son Mahlon and give the family a son who could continue their name and their inheritance, and to make sure that she did not have to sell her possessions, some land that she had in Elimelech's family that she would need to keep herself alive. This marriage would benefit everyone. It would give a home and a rest for Ruth. It would give a wife and an heir to Boaz and a place for a mother-in-law and a widowed relative to live and be secure. Her plan had common sense to it. It would benefit everybody. It also was compassionate. It was motivated, we think, by her question to Ruth, "My daughter, should I not find a place of rest for you?" But it was also a little bit conniving. It was calculating in order to benefit Naomi as well as Ruth and Boaz. And here is her logic. Boaz is their relative, and he just happens to be wealthy. He likes Ruth because he's treated her with extraordinary kindness. He's already admitted to people that Ruth is a worthy woman, a woman of great and noble character. Ruth is young and available, and we would assume, at least to Boaz, she is attractive. Boaz is a bachelor who could use a wife and a son to carry on his legacy and to receive his inheritance. And Boaz is a righteous man who will always attempt to do the honorable thing, like a Levirate marriage. And Naomi is a Jewish mother. And Jewish mothers are supposed to interfere and make matches. And her culture, really, we laugh at that, but since she was the surviving elder of her little family, which at this point was only Ruth, it was her responsibility to make sure that her daughter-in-law, who was now her daughter, was cared for and that arrangements were made. So Naomi asked Ruth permission. I want you to notice that. She doesn't do this just like a bull in a china shop. She says, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" Ruth did not have to agree with this. She could have said, "No, I have my eye on another young man. I'm not interested in Boaz. I prefer not to do this." But she's seeking rest. She's seeking here the word manoah, which means to find a settled place. She was seeking a settled domestic life for Ruth, and Ruth was free to reject or accept this plan. But she doesn't. Ruth says, "Whatever you say, I will do." We don't know, honestly, folks, we don't know the procedure by which these Levirate contracts and these Levirate laws were enacted. But it assumes from the passages we read that the individual that was in need would approach the elders of the community and say, "I have need of Levirate redemption." For some reason, Naomi does not do that. She should have, she could have, but she doesn't. We need to also know that according to chapter 4, we'll find out next week, that there was a parcel of land involved in this. So whoever the next of kin was, the Goel, the kinsman redeemer, it came as a package deal. He had to redeem both the piece of land, which most men would like to have, but also the young lady. And a lot of men wouldn't want this. It would be difficult for them to take a second wife. Their wife wouldn't like that. To take on a completely second family, not only the wife, but whatever children came from that wife. He could be doubling his financial and familial responsibilities. Leon Morris says, "The Israelites were not the absolute owners of the land. The land was God's. They did not hold it for their own, but in trust. They could not sell it. If times were hard and money was short, they could indeed part with the lamb, but there was always the right and the duty of redemption, and always the year of Jubilee on the horizon. When a man's financial state improved, he must buy back the land which God gave to him and his family. And if he could not do this, or would not, then his goel, his kinsman redeemer, must do it for him. That redemption of land was regarded as important, and we see this in the story of Ruth, where the land is mentioned even before Ruth is, in chapter 4, verse 3. There appears to be a specific order of who was the goel. If we go back to that Leviticus chapter we read, it says one of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle, or his cousin, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him. So in the Levirate pecking order, it was the brother's responsibility first. If he couldn't, then the uncle. If he would not, then the cousin. If not the cousin, then a nephew, or some other close relative. Now, here was Naomi's plight. Naomi needed the Levirate law to save her property, marry her daughter-in-law, and provide support for Naomi. But she wanted Boaz to do that because Boaz was a wealthy man and a good man, a righteous man, the text says several times, and he obviously loved Ruth. But there we'll find out in chapter 4, there was another redeemer closer as a relative to Naomi and Ruth than Boaz, and he could claim the right. He could say, I'll take the land and I'll take the girl, which would not have pleased either Ruth or Naomi. So Naomi begins to be manipulative. She was running ahead of God's providence, and she was trying to circumvent the law of God to a certain extent to get what she and Ruth wanted. Her motives, in other words, friends, was not 100% pure. Her methods were fraught with sinful machinations, and yet here's the amazing thing in the story. The sovereign God takes what Naomi plans and uses it for his own divine purposes. Robert Hubbard, in his commentary on Ruth, says, a significant theological point emerges here in the story. Earlier, Naomi had wished for these things for her daughter, that God would give her a rest. Here, human means, that is Naomi's plan, carry out something previously understood to be God's province. In response to providentially given opportunities, Naomi began to answer her own prayers. She thus models in one way something which divine and human actions must face as they work together in something called the providence of God. Believers are not always to wait patiently for things just to happen. They must seize the initiative when an opportunity presents itself. They assume that God presents the opportunity, and this was no doubt Naomi's assumption. God would make the full payment, but he would use the efforts of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz to bring about his will, so that in this case, Naomi's actions and God's actions coincide. That is, what Naomi does constitutes what God acts, and he acts to execute his own divine plan in spite of the motives of the human being cooperating with him. Our little Westminster Confession of Faith says that God orders his providence to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. He uses our decisions, sometimes motivated by not the purest of motives. And our plans, although they're often mixed with spiritual principles and selfish desires, he uses these things to bring about his sovereign will. And Ruth agrees with the plan. She is complicit with the whole story. She could have said, now, Mom, I want to tell you, this is really not the way we're supposed to do things. But she says, whatever you say, I will do. We know this from Joseph, that what men intend for evil, God often uses for good. And here was a story were that as true as ever. So we have this plan of Naomi that leads to a proposal from Ruth. That's the second paragraph. And the second thing we learn in this story, that Ruth actually proposes to Boaz in chapter 3, beginning in verse 6. So she, that is Ruth, went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after a young man, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now, it is true that I am a redeemer. Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good. Let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning." Boaz is at work. In his day, they harvested from sunup to sundown. And so in the evening, they would light fires in a flat open place where the wind was strong. And they would winnow the barley. They would take it and throw it up in the air repeatedly. As it hit the ground, the husk would crack, and they would keep throwing it up until the husk, the lighter part, the chaff blew away, and the grain fell down. Then they would sweep it into piles, and they would no doubt put some mark on it to show that it was theirs, because this was a community threshing floor. This was the threshing floor for the whole area of Rafratha, or the whole region of Bethlehem. And so the landowner, the man in charge and the owner of that grain, in this case Boaz, would sleep by the piles of grain just to make sure that no one else claimed what he harvested and threshed. The hour had finished and he was resting. He ate, he drank, his heart was merry. That doesn't mean he was drunk. He was just feeling good. He'd had a successful day and a good harvest. The wine had relaxed him. The food had filled his stomach. And as he drifted off to sleep, a young woman, veiled so no one knew who she was, came up beside him and uncovered his feet and lay down beside him. Now, scholars have asked for years what she was doing. Was what she was doing sexually illicit? Was it seductive and provocative? Because the word for feet can mean anything from the loins down. Could mean the whole leg. It could mean to uncover parts of a man that were not appropriate to be seen in public. Depending upon the scholar, they either give the benefit of the doubt or they assume that Ruth was doing something sexually provocative. But I believe that Leon Morse is right. The context makes it clear that this describes a way whereby Ruth signified to Boaz her desire to marry him. Ordinary methods of approach were no doubt difficult, and this provided a suitable median. But why should it be done in this way? We do not know. For we do not know whether this was a widely practiced custom or not. It is attested in no other place in the Bible but here. The narrator uses the utmost delicacy in describing what happened, and it is clear that Naomi's plan was not without its dangers. The fact that she was prepared to urge this course of action on Ruth and Boaz is the measure of her trust and the character of both of these individuals. What we think merely happened was this. She uncovered his feet so that he would wake up in the night cold and find her there when everybody else was asleep. And then a very delicate transaction could take place. Boaz had not taken the initiative for two reasons. He felt he was too old for Ruth. He says that in this passage. And he realized that there was someone else who was in line before him, and it would have been inappropriate for him to try to supersede the closer relatives' goel responsibilities and privileges. He realized also that it would be awkward for him to try to propose marriage when it could not work, or when the elders of the city would have found fault with him for trying to do so. This Levirate law seems to have been very seldom practiced because it was not popular. You can imagine the difficulty it would bring into the family. If we had time tonight, all we'd have to do to prove that point is to turn to Genesis chapter 38, to the story of a man named Judah and his daughter-in-law named Tamar. He had a son that he gave as a husband to this young girl named Tamar, and the boy died. So, according to the Levirate law, he took his second-born son, and he married her to this girl, and then he died. He had one son left, and the Bible says he said in his heart, I will not give my son to her, lest he die also, and I have no heir. So he said to his daughter-in-law, your brother is too young. Wait till he reaches maturity of age, and then I will contract the marriage. But he reneged on his promise. You know what Tamar did? She dressed herself as a prostitute. She seduced Judah. She was pregnant by him. And when she revealed what she had done, and that Judah was the father, that he had gone back against the Levirate law and reneged on his promise, Judah said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. And he did not know her again, but cared for her. It sounds like an odd law, and it was. And it was a difficult thing to convince men to take on that responsibility. So Naomi and Ruth devise a plan that is both tactful, discreet, and honorable. Ruth goes unnoticed and secretly to Boaz. She devises a way to awaken him in the middle of the night when no one else will hear what's going on except the two of them sitting or lying next to each other. She tests out to see whether he has cold feet, figuratively and realistically. Whether he's willing to follow through with this. And if he says no, then she does it in such a way that it's no embarrassment to him and no shame or dishonor to her. So Ruth proposes to Boaz. She answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your garment, literally, spread your garment over your servant, for you are a redeemer. To spread the mantle or the garment over someone was to take them as wife. Listen to Ezekiel chapter 16 and to what God says to Israel. When I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord, and you became my wife. To spread the garment over someone was to propose marriage. David Atkinson says, this was a delicate request for marriage. The spreading of the garment is referred to in the passage of Ezekiel in the Lord as his word of love for Jerusalem and Israel, his future wife. Even until just a few decades ago, this was the practice in the Hebrew world. The Quran gives instructions. He says in the commentary on Hebrew life and an explanation of the Quran, one writer says, in the Jahiliyyah, where a man's father and brother or son die, and they leave a widow, the dead man's heir, if he comes at once and throws his garment over her, has the right to marry her under the dowry, that is, the dowry already paid by her deceased husband, and he has the right to take her as his wife, or give her in marriage and to keep her dowry. So it was a Middle Eastern practice to do this. And Boaz accepts. He agrees to follow through as a goel, as a kinsman redeemer, to see if he can arrange to marry Ruth and purchase Elimelech's land and take Naomi as a dependent. Here's what he says. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. That leads to the third and final paragraph about the precaution of Boaz. So she lay at his feet until morning, but arose before one could recognize her. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, that is, Naomi replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Boaz takes the precaution of scandal. He does so for a legal reason, you'll find out in a minute. But under the cover of night, before everyone has arisen, he says, "I want to load you up with some grain." That grain is a pledge. It's a symbol of a dowry that he will pay for both Naomi's land, Naomi and Ruth as a wife. It gives Naomi an indication that he is a man who has good intentions. But it also is an excuse. Because if someone sees Ruth going home at the crack of dawn with about a bushel of grain over her shoulder, they will assume that she worked late and helped thresh all night, and that was her share of the produce as she went home, and it would free her from scandal. But there is also a reason, we think, that was legal. Why Boaz? He took this precaution to cover himself. In the present-day Mishnah, which was written centuries after Ruth and Boaz's story was in history, the Mishnah says that if a man has sexual intercourse with a Gentile woman, then he could not perform the duties or privileges of the Levirate marriage with that Gentile woman. Boaz was protecting himself from any accusation that he spent the night with Ruth and therefore disqualified himself from marrying her. Now, that may not have been in place during the days of Boaz and Ruth, but I'm assuming that the reason it's in the Mishnah written several hundred years later is because it was a standard accepted practice among Jews, especially when they were dealing with people like a young Moabitess. So Boaz takes precaution to make sure that Naomi sees his good intentions, that he's been honorable with her daughter-in-law. He takes precautions to protect the reputation of young Ruth and takes precautions to make sure that he does nothing to hinder his legal right to attempt to be the Goel or the kinsman redeemer. And Ruth and Naomi accept it that way. Naomi says, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for this man will not rest until this matter is settled today. He will go about his business and do what he has to do." Now, it's at this point in the story that evangelical scholars love to jump in and show you that Jesus Christ is the kinsman redeemer. And I'm here to tell you that that's inappropriate to do in chapter 3. It's okay to do it in chapter 4 when he acts as the kinsman redeemer, and what he does is a type or symbol of what Christ would do for us later on. But the object of this story is about God's providence. And it's about the providence that God mediates to people primarily through a family. That's what this story is about. It's about family obligations. And I may be wrong, I may be unkind to us evangelicals, but sometimes I think we love to jump in there and insert Jesus Christ into the story because it makes us feel like we're being gospel people. But you know what? There could be another motive. It could be our intent to spiritualize away a clear and practical exhortation for us to fulfill our family responsibilities. That's what these Levirate laws were all about. They truly were not. They were not looking forward to Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ fulfills these laws, but Moses had no idea that Jesus Christ would be a Goel, a kinsman redeemer. He makes it clear every time he lays down these laws in Deuteronomy 35, Leviticus 25, and Numbers 5, that he's giving these things that because the people have a covenant with God and with each other. They are God's family and related to each other. And what he's telling us is something that our church and, quite frankly, our society needs to know. that when the family breaks down, all sorts of horrible things happen. There are, in Israelites' case, young women without anyone to care for them and old widows without a family to protect them. Land is lost. People become indentured slaves. Inheritances and family names disappear. And God said, that is not the way I made a covenant with you. I bought you out of slavery. I threw my skirt over you when I saw you in the wilderness of Egypt and made you my wife. I gave you a land and a name and an inheritance. And I'm not going to let you lose those things, even in your own irresponsibility and mismanagement. And that is true for us. We're studying today in our church this Get Off Your Donkey series. We don't have time tonight. I've just got a couple minutes. But if I were to take you to 1 Timothy and show you the responsibility for a family to care for widows, where God says, if a man will not care for the members of his own household, he's worse than an unbeliever. Where we are to fulfill our responsibilities to our children and to our parents. Where we're to take care of the members of the household of faith, to bear one another's burdens, and do good to all men, especially to the household of faith. All of these commands, both as a literal family and as a spiritual family, a covenant family. We can see these principles in the Old Testament applied by the apostles in the New. Why do we have abortions? Why do we have high school dropouts? Elderly people who can't care for themselves? Prisoners coming out of jail with no one to help them with reentry? Women sold into sex trafficking? And all of these other things, including refugees that we've been studying with Get Off Your Donkey, because all of these people have one thing in common. In some way, their family is either absent and unable to help them, or it's failed them at a crucial hour. Why are we talking about homeless children? If they're children, don't they have a mom and a dad? Or an aunt and an uncle? Or a grandma and a grandpa? Where's the family to take care of these people? Why is this young woman pregnant going to an abortion clinic instead of going to her father and mother and saying, I'm in the family way and I need your help? And why doesn't the father step up as a goel, a kinsman redeemer, and throw his mantle of respectability over his daughter and say, we will care for you and for our child, regardless of how in the providence of God you have brought this child into our family? Why do people resort to these desperate things? I suggest to you it's because the American family is failing and because the American church is not acting as a spiritual family. And all of these responsibilities are now being foisted upon our government. Responsibilities the government doesn't want. Why do we have this new law that everybody has to have medical insurance, which is throwing the whole economy into a whack? We wouldn't have to have that law. If a man and a wife who were working and had income said to their family members, whatever your medical needs are, we will put you on our policy, pay the extra premium, and care for you because you're our family. That's what the problem is. And that's what God is trying to show us, that his prevailing goodness to people who are pregnant out of wedlock, homeless and on the street, dropping out of high school and without a job, elderly and alone, caught in trafficking, prisoners reentering society, refugees away from family and church in a land where they don't even speak the language. All of these people need their family or their church to help them. And God's providence is usually mediated to us through these institutions of family and church. Which means, folks, that before we jump to chapter 4 and rightfully conclude that Jesus is our kinsman redeemer, we need to realize that in some way, every one of us in this room is a redeemer to someone else. Every one of us is here as a member of a family or a member of a church to throw our mantle over another person and say, whatever you want, I will do for you. for this is what the Lord requires for us in our covenant. That's the story of Ruth. It's more radical than the cross of Jesus Christ. It takes the kinsman redeemer office of Jesus Christ and places it on every single one of us to care for our aging parents, our children who are in trouble, our brother who's in jail, our uncle who's lost his mind and is addicted to alcohol and now lives on the street, our nephew who dropped out of school, the refugee that moves in next door to us and lives illegally as an alien without a green card. All of these things become incumbent upon us to act like Boaz and do the kinsman redeemer responsibility for them. It's a lot to think about, but I think that's what this story tonight is saying. God's providence does not always come directly from heaven to us. It usually is mediated through other people and primarily our family and our church. And that's the story that Ruth is pointing to. The story that goes on generation after generation and sucks us into this great narrative where we care for other people because they are ours, our people, our family, our church, our sacred covenant, and its community. Let's pray. Father, we want to thank you that you are a God who lives not by contract, but by covenant. Not for what is best for you, for what you can get out of it, the most for the least, but by a mutual pledge that you will be our God if we will be your people. You do care for us in amazing ways. And you give us our families and our churches to back you up and assist you in this providential care. Those sacred blessings we have become sacred responsibilities that we have for one another and for those whom you have sovereignly, providentially placed in our life. We face in our country many social and spiritual woes because the American family has broken down and the American church is disinterested in becoming redemptive. We ask by the grace of Jesus Christ that you would change us here as family members at Christ's covenant, as church members here in this community of faith, to become redeemers to other people, to give to other people what they need, because they are, by your design, through no choice of our own, born spiritually or physically into a covenant with us, and they are our people, our flesh and blood, and our brothers and sisters in the Lord. It is Jesus Christ who will empower us to do this. He will enable us to do this because indeed in this story, behind this story, is the greater story of his Goel institution, his kinsman redeemer activity, his redemption of us out of the slavery of sin, out of death, where he avenges us against the murder of mankind, the devil, and his great love for us, where he takes us as the bride of Christ, the church, and gives us not only life, but respectability and a name and inheritance forever in heaven. So we ask for the grace of Jesus Christ to fill us this evening, to make us people who are true kinsmen, and to care for those whom you have put in our charge, that we might give you great blessing and be a benefit to our families and communities, and a witness to Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.